Greetings, travellers, and welcome to episode 64 of the Innsmouth Book Club podcast. Yes, we're here today at the bookshop for our scheduled visit. I'm one of your hosts, Tim Mendes.
And I'm the other one, Rob Poyton. Yes, we've got a very nice story lined up today, a mythos classic, one that doesn't get a lot of coverage.
I think because we're covering Frank Belknap Long, and I think most people, if you say that name, will think Hounds of Tyndalos.
Tyndalos, yeah. Yes. Although it does share a character with Tyndalos, but we'll get to that in the genus, of course.
indeed, yeah.
Now, before we get into all that literary stuff, I just wanted to say a huge thank you, because as you may have heard from last time, we've just launched the Kickstart for the 6th Innsmouth Gold anthology, The Pickman Papers, which is Lovecraft in a Dickensian setting. And, well, I'm not often speechless, but I was gobsmacked to see that we hit our target on the first day. It's quite amazing.
Outstanding. Yeah, I was shocked. I was really shocked. Yeah, because one of our other contributors had posted up a picture saying that it was sort of like about 50 quid shy or something. Yeah, when he posted this thing. So I thought, I know, I'll have a look. And it was like 150 quid over by the time I looked. I was like, what?
Yeah. And now it's up to, well, it's up way beyond our set target, which is absolutely fantastic. So a huge thanks to everyone who's backed it so far. And of course, you know, do take a look, and we appreciate any support you get. What that means is now we've hit the target is production of the book can start straight away. And it also means we'll be able to get a couple of extra stories in as well. Because as always with these anthologies, I get so many great stories in from the Innsmouth writing circle. And, you know, what with costs and space and everything else, we can't always get everything in. But I'm pleased to say on this one, now we've hit that target, we'll be able to get all the stories in. So really looking forward to getting that one out. And thanks again.
Yeah, I've just had so much fun writing that. I said to you in the email when I sent you the story, it's literally the most purple thing I have ever written. It's all that reading Clark Ashton Smith. I was perfectly primed for it.
It does have an effect. I've noticed that as well. Yeah, it definitely does have an effect. Yeah. And we have our own event coming up, 30th of September, the Innsmouth Literary Festival. We've got Ramsey Campbell appearing live on Zoom. We've got Greg Johnson and Chris Lackey bringing some films along to show. We've got authors there. We've got, I think we're up to about 15 traders now. We've got some really interesting traders coming in.
Excellent.
And there's going to be a lot of gaming going on as well.
Yeah.
As always, we'll put the link up in the show notes below for that. And we'd love to see you there. In fact, one of our patrons has already signed up. I think it was Graham, I think. So thanks for that. Patrons get free entry, remember? So we do hope to see you there.
Nice one.
Shall we man up and face the horror from the hills? What do you think?
Indeed. Yeah, I think we should. Yeah. It's a great, great story. I forgot it was a novella when you first suggested it. I'd forgotten it was a novella. And when I come to media, I was like, oh, it's a bit long. Blimey, I forgot it was so long. But it doesn't feel long, if you know what I mean. Mm. I rattled through it really quickly again, you know.
Yeah. And obviously the author is Frank Belknap Long. Now, we've spoken about him before when we covered the Hounds of Tyndalos. I can't remember which episode that was, but we'll put a link to that below. So there we spoke a little bit about Long's life. But of course, he was a very close friend of Lovecraft, and they met a number of times. And I have a book called Dreamer on the Night Side that I bought years ago from Arkham Press. There's a story behind that, but I'll save that for another time. So we were thinking what it would be nice to do as a patron special is dip into Dreamer on the Night Side and look at some of his stories about the times he spent with Lovecraft and that kind of thing.
Yeah, it'd be similar to what we do with the Clark Ashton Smith letters and things like that. They always end up being really fun episodes. So I think to do that, like dip into Lovecraft's life from the perspective of one of his close chums would be, really good fun, I think. Yeah.
Yes. So that's going to be upcoming in about a month's time. We'll probably do that next month. So other than that, what do we know about Mr. Long and this story in particular?
Well, this story in particular was originally titled The Elephant God of Leng. Yeah, it was then renamed the Elephant God of Tasang.
Okay.
Basically, to begin with, it was set obviously in Leng, and it was it also included August Derleth's Teko Teko people.
All right.
However the hell you pronounce them.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, Long decided because he couldn't quite get it to work using Derleth's. He was just like, I'll tell you what, I'm going to create my own group that lived basically just down the road on another plateau. So that's what this is. Sesung is an occult plateau just down the road from Leng. And they are on this race of ne'er-do-wells, which we'll get to later, are basically a counterpart of the Teko Teko.
Right.
The Horror from the Hills was published in serial form in the January and February/March editions of Weird Tales in 1931, and it was later reprinted by Arkham House in 1963.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm. Because Long lived into the, I believe he passed away in the 1990s, I think.
Yeah.
So he was one of the longer lived of that circle, and again, it's nice that they live long enough to at least see the return of Lovecraft, if you like, and a mythos fiction.
Yeah. I think it was either him or Block, wasn't it, who were the last two living? Because I guess they were the youngest at the time.
Yeah, well, you know? Bobby Block was like, wasn't he like 16 or 17 or something when he was, something like that.
Yeah, I don't think Belknap Long was that old. He was probably in his early 20s or something at the time. Yeah. So,
Now, the other thing we want to say about this is you can see here in the shop browsing Tim's fine collection of musty tomes. We actually have three editions or three books that contain this story. And one that I found that I like here, this is called The Golden Age of Weird Fiction, Frank Belknap Long. And it's volume one, edited by Sean Garrett. And this collects together a lot of Long's mythos and some sci-fi stories as well. I've really only just got it recently, so I've only read The Horror from the Hills. But outstanding collection. We've got things like At the Home of Poe, The Desert Lich, The Devil God, The Man with a Thousand Legs. That sounds interesting. Nice. The Space Eaters, of course, The Hounds of Tindalos. A Visitor from Egypt, which is one of his well-known stories. So, yeah, a really nice collection that's worth looking out for.
Yeah. I'm working from the Tindalos cycle, which is a continuation of the cycle books that Chaosium put out. But this one was actually... Basically, what happened was Chaosium decided they weren't putting out anymore, but the editor still had some to put out. So Hippocampus basically picked up the ball that Chaosium dropped. So this was put out by Hippocampus in 2010.
Oh, right.
And yeah, it's, as you would imagine, it's basically the Long mythos. It contains all of his sort of Tindalos stuff, all of his Cthulhu mythos stuff, and all the Chogna Forn stuff. But it also contains stories written by other people using Long's creations. So you've also got a couple of stories in here that were the possible inspirations for the Hounds of Tindalos. That's something I liked about these cycle books. So you've got The Maker of Moons by Robert Chambers, which has the Hounds of Yith, and The Death of Halpin Frazer, Ambrose Bierce, obviously for the name, obviously. But for the stories that use Long's creations, you've got people such as Peter Cannon, Lynn Carter, Anne K. Schrader, Adrian Cole, Ramsey Campbell, C.J. Henderson, Robert Block, and Stanley C. Sargent. Yeah, Robert Block's story in here is a really good one that we should look into at some point. It's called Death is an Elephant.
What a great name.
It's a brilliant name, isn't it?
That could almost be like an Agatha Christie novel, couldn't it?
Yeah.
Death is an elephant.
Oh, yeah. Oh, now you got me thinking. I'm going to have to do a follow-up to Spiffing, aren't I?
Elephant scene. Elephants. I should mention as well, the collection I spoke about was Wildside Press, and that was published in 2016, I believe. But now from there we go way back in time, because this is an edition that I've had for a long, long time. It's called The Horror from the Hills, and this was published, well, first published in 1964 in the US, but the copy I have here was a 1965 reprint, and it was printed in England by Brown Watson Limited, who I like to think of as perhaps a cousin of Brown Jenkin.
Yeah. Oh, you could see that. Yeah. A chap version of Brown Jenkin.
Yeah. With a little deerstalker hat on or something.
Yeah, yeah. A little twirly moustache. Yeah.
And this is a collection of three stories. It's The Horror from the Hills, Flame of Life, and Giant in the Forest. And it's got that lovely old book thing. It's a hugely creased cover and those really nicely yellowed pages. And it's one of those books that I don't actually read now because, you know, they get
apart.
Quite fragile. And there were two things on the cover that I thought I'd just mention. One is whatever the bookseller was I bought it from, kindly put in crayon on the front 1 and 7, because the price of the book was originally 2 and 6, it says inside, 1 and 7 for non-British readers or readers under a certain age. That's pre-decimal money.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
Like a shilling and 7 pence. Yeah. And then the blurb on the front is really nice. It's The Horror from the Hills, 5 exclamation marks. This novel was written inside a capsule traveling through space to a dimension we should never hope to know, with quite a creepy picture on the front of a man enveloped in sort of cobwebs or something. So
nice.
they don't do covers like that anymore, do they?
They don't. They really don't. I'm just wondering if that was sort of like the reprint of the Arkham House one from 63.
It could have been taken from that, yeah.
Yeah, could have been taken from that, because that was The Horror from the Hills was, I think there was a couple of other stories in that.
Oh, right. Well, it says here Belmont Productions, but I don't know who they were.
Oh, right. No idea.
And we've got, it says original title, Odd Science Fiction, so maybe that was another, I don't know where they would have been picked up from, to be honest.
No.
If not Arkham House, who else would have been putting that out?
Mm.
Yeah, that might be worth delving into.
Yeah. Yes. You know, the mysteries of publishing, you know.
Mm,
it's all a bit arcane at times, isn't it?
it is yes. Okay, so let's delve into the story, and we start with chapter one, The Coming of the Stone Beast.
Yeah, I love these chapter titles. I was thinking that as I was reading it, I was just thinking they could be great story titles on their own.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
The Coming of the Stone Beast.
Yeah. And it's a modern setting, but well, by modern I mean contemporary for long. So we're looking at sort of 1930s, and most of the action takes place or is centered around a museum. And the opening paragraph describes a long, low-ceilinged room adorned with Egyptian, Greco-Roman, Minoan, and Assyrian antiquities, where a thin, careless-seeming young man of 26. Sits jubilantly humming. It's a nice opening. Again, we're kind of not in that musty scholar sort of field, are we? Although he is a scholar, as we find out.
Yeah,
it's a younger person. It seems a little bit more refreshing and young than Lovecraft, perhaps.
Yeah, but we're definitely in the tweed zone, because he actually mentions in this second bit of description here, there's nothing in his appearance or manner suggested the scholar. He wore grey tweeds of Ivy League cut, a pinstriped blue shirt with a button-down collar, and a ridiculously brilliant necktie. I'm seeing him almost as a P.G. Woodhouse kind of character, you know?
Yeah.
He's a bit of a Bertie Wooster, isn't he, by the looks of him? A bit flash.
Yeah. You can imagine him on the golf course kind of thing.
Yeah, and he's plus fours. Yeah.
It's probably got, what's one of those cars called? A Fliver or something like that? He's got one of those sort of early versions of a sports car. He's a bit of a young buck, isn't he?
Yeah.
And his name is Algernon Harris, and he's quite used to people not taking him seriously or thinking he's like the office boy or something.
Yeah.
But he's actually got postgraduate degrees from Yale and Oxford, although he never puts PhD after his name. He's quite a modest chap. And this is what endeared him to the directors of the Manhattan Museum of Fine Arts, which is where we are, and prompted their unanimous choice of him to succeed the late Halping Chalmers as Curator of Archaeology. Now, we've heard that name before, haven't we?
We have indeed. Yeah, the late Halpin Chalmers, last seen covered in blue goop on the floor of a room with a load of Lao up his hooter. Yeah.
Lao up his hooter. Cause of death, Lao up his hooter.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and it's there from that name where we get the Ambrose Bierce connection.
Yeah.
To, you know, Halpin Fraser. And Halpin Chalmers, it's believed that Chalmers was a nod to Chambers, Robert Chambers.
Oh, right. So that's like two Easter eggs in one lane. Nice.
Indeed. Nice. Yeah.
And I do like that about these authors. And I mean, it's something a lot of authors, we certainly like to do it as well. You sprinkle these little Easter eggs throughout. It's fun to try and spot them. And I'm sure there's quite a lot we miss as well. So if you do know of any that we miss, then do let us know. So Harris has been here for 6 months and is doing very well. So boyishly ebullient was he, so consumed with investigative zeal that his field work has contracted his enthusiasm as though it were kind of fever. So he's got these people out roaming around the world looking for artifacts and relics, which they then bring back to the museum. When we say looking for, what we really mean is stealing, isn't it? Let's be...
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And some of these guys, these chaps that, you know, there's basically a list here of all these great, wonderful things that they've found. These geometric vases from Crete and all these kind of things. But there's a bit of a cost, isn't there, for some of these guys?
Yes. Yeah, and I love some of these descriptions. Yeah, yeah. Simmons was a Chang Dynasty specialist, and he had been obliged to leave his left eye and a piece of his nose in a Buddhist temple near a place called Fenchao Fu.
Yes, when Algernon questioned him, he could only mumble something about a small, malignant face with corpsey eyes that had glared and glared at him out of a purple mist. And Francis Hogarth had lost £80 and a perfectly good right arm somewhere between Lake Rudolph and Naivasha in the Anglo-Egyptian Sudan.
A perfectly good right arm. Lucky he had a bad one.
Yeah, that's brilliant. And then the description's like, yeah, obliged to leave his eye and a piece of his nose and a perfectly good arm.
Corpsey eyes is nice as well. And yeah, that's a nice description. Now, I don't want to alarm our visitors here or our listeners, but you may be hearing a bit of an odd sort of trumpeting noise in the background. We didn't want to say, but we do have Chalgna Fawn in the back at the moment.
Yeah.
I believe you're looking after him before he goes into the museum for exhibit.
Yes, I am. I've got to look after him, and thankfully I don't have to nurse him, which we'll find out about later. But yeah, it's a little figurine. He's only a little Chalgna Fawn.
Makes a big noise for a little fella.
Exactly. Exactly.
So then we get this news that we get a phone call from one of these field workers, Clark Allman, who seems very keen to explain about how he's found the elephant god of Sang, and he's sending it back, or he's got three men are going to deliver it. It's a strange, loathsome thing, Algernon, an unholy thing, and I shall insist that you destroy it, which obviously comes as some surprise to Algernon.
Yeah. So you may photograph it and study it, but you've got to destroy it. You'll understand when you see what I have become. I love that in italics as well, just for added emphasis. You know, brilliant.
And we get this little backstory about the elephant god here. Apparently other people have gone to look for it. Richardson drew it before they empowered him. Allman has crossed the desert plateau on foot. He's crossed above the graves of Steelbraith, Tacken, McWilliams, Henley and Holmes. So quite a few guys have gone in search of, well, we assume they're guys, have gone in search of this idol. But Allman is the only one to have found it and actually taken it.
Yeah. Apparently his escape was a sheer miracle. He had displayed extraordinary courage and endurance when they had tortured him, and it was merely because they couldn't kill him that the priest was impressed. Sounds like a rough night out, that, doesn't it? Blimey.
Yeah, yeah. So not only did he survive the torture, he somehow engineered an escape, or perhaps they let him go out of respect for his toughness, and he managed to take this statue or idol with him somehow. It's a little bit odd, because this is then where the package turns up. the delivery men, UPS, turn up. And it's three harshly breathing men staggering beneath a heavy burden. So it takes three men to lift it. It's obviously a fair old weight.
Yeah, it's not like he slipped it in his pocket, is it? It's,
no, you wonder how he got it away, really. Mm. And this is where we get our second inkling of something is wrong, because one of the delivery guys said, oh, yes, Mr. Allman sent us the poor guy. And well, what do you mean by poor guy? And the delivery guy says, well, it's on account of his face. There's something wrong with it. He keeps it covered and won't let nobody look at it. Good God, murmured Algernon. They've mutilated him. So that's his first thought, that part of this torture was this sort of mutilation.
Yeah, so after the men file out, decides to unwrap this monstrosity and have a look. And what a great description we've got here. Words could not adequately convey the repulsiveness of the thing. It was endowed with a trunk and great uneven ears, and two enormous tusks protruded from the corners of its mouth. But it was not an elephant. Indeed, its resemblance to an actual elephant was, at best, sporadic and superficial, despite certain unmistakable points of similarity. The ears were webbed and tentacled. The trunk terminated in a huge flaring disc, at least a foot in diameter, and the tusks were intertwined and interlocked at the base of the statue, were as translucent as rock crystal.
So this is nice. It's elephant is a sort of vague word for it. I think we're not really in sort of Ganesh territory. You know, that's the things that people will think of immediately. Would be that kind of shape or form.
Yeah.
But at best, it sort of resembles an elephant in some of its features, which is nice because we get an idea of it, but not quite the alienness of it as well. It's left to the imagination.
Yeah, I love the tentacled ears. I'd spent a ridiculous amount of time trying to picture them in my head. The big flappy elephant ears with tentacles coming off them.
Yeah, that's a weird sort of mixture of things, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, like Dumbo goes Cthuloid.
And it sat upon a pedestal, or squatted on a pedestal, of black onyx. The statue itself, with the exception of the tusks, had apparently been chiselled from a single block of stone, and was so hideously mottled and eroded and discoloured that it looked in spots as though it had been dipped in sanies. The thing sat bolt upright. Its forearms were bent stiffly at the elbow, and its hands, it had human hands, rested palm upwards on its lap. And then he draws a comparison with a Buddha. This is nice. As quiescent as a Buddha, enigmatic as a Sphinx, and malignantly poised as a Gorgon or cockatrice. So again, we get that nice combination of characteristics from things that we recognize, and it's a combination of these things. You can't just say, oh, that's just a Buddha. It's also has that Sphinx quality.
Yeah, it's a great description. And I like the way it sort of links itself in, whether it was a conscious thing or not, in the next paragraph when it talks about what stone it was made, because it reminds me of parallels of the Cthulhu idol that was found in the swamp. Because again, course, it's a strange greenish rock that sort of exudes, you know, sort of sweaty green rock kind of thing, you know.
I think whatever mythos, deity or creature it is, it's got to be black onyx or greenish stone. Yeah.
And this is both. It's that the base is black onyx. Yeah. And
And it's at this point that Allman suddenly turns up. And yes, his face is covered. Only the eyes can be seen above the black silk scarf. Of course, he goes over to see his friend and grips him by the shoulders, and Allman recoils. He doesn't even like being touched. Yeah.
The wounds haven't healed. It doesn't want them to heal.
Ooh. Yes, and here's our first inclination that no, his wounds were not from the torture, because he says, every night it comes and lays the disc on them. I can't stand being touched.
Yeah, I see this disc on the trunk almost like a lamprey.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's that kind of sucker-like mouth, isn't it? I see lots of jagged teeth like a lamprey, you know.
Yeah, that's a very good thought, actually, yeah. Because it's a little bit easy to think of this as being a bit of a silly monster in a way.
Yeah. You know?
It's an elephant with tentacles on its ears, and it's got a trunk with a sort of disc on the end. It doesn't necessarily sound that scary, but when you start putting it into those terms,
yeah,
and all these other ideas that is put in there as well, yeah, it takes on a far more sinister hue.
Yeah, because I mean, there's a comparison later to its hunger being akin to the vampire bat and things like that. So you get this trunk isn't for something for taking peanuts off circus performers. this is for sucking the life out of somebody, you know, like some horrible, knotty, bloody vacuum or something, you know. It's, yeah, when you think about it like that, it's pretty grim.
And this is where we sort of get the backstory of how he came by the statue and how he found it and everything else. We get quite a long and detailed passage. And this is something that Long does. I think in other stories, this might have been covered in a paragraph of something, but we get quite a detailed account of his journey, of what happened to him. And it's this idea of Chowglafawn has willed it, that he becomes his companion. There's even talk of a prophecy about a white man's going to come and take Chaugner away. It's almost like the god wants to return to civilization or something like that.
Yeah, specifically taken to America. It was all part of a big plan that the old elephant god had put in motion.
Yes, they call him the White Acolyte. Has confirmed that you are about to become a great universal god filling all space. He will carry you safely into the world and nurse you until you have no further need of him. That's a little bit ominous, isn't it?
Isn't it just? Yeah.
As we were saying before, you think initially, right, he was tortured and he managed to escape. No, he was actually let go. Perhaps the torture was a form of trial in that sense to make sure he was the chosen one.
Yeah.
And we get our first mention of blood here. Red blood is Chaugner's staff. Without it, my god would suffer tortures no man could endure. It is impossible for a man to know how great can be the suffering of a god. So our elephant god is a vampire.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
And that's confirmed when we get this description of Chaugner feeding on Ormond.
Yeah, this is a great passage. I love this scene. Basically, he wakes with a start and a strange impression that he wasn't alone in the cave. Before he opens his eyes, he knows that something unspeakably malign was crouching or squatting on the ground beside me. I could hear it breathing in the darkness, and the stench of it strangled the breath in my throat. And yeah, basically, as he sits up, there's suddenly a ponderous weight on his chest. He's basically been pinned down. and to me, it brings, like, if you've ever had like them nightmares, that sleep paralysis, that's what that reminds me of to me. And that's a horrible feeling. And yeah, I mean, it's all there, isn't it? Yeah. Well, imagine you open your eyes and it's a...
That is, yeah, that's a very hard. And I wonder if part of this point, because I did read somewhere that Long drew inspiration from one of Lovecraft's nightmares.
Mm.
So I don't know if that's this particular scene, because you're right, this does sound very night hag kind of thing, and it's sleep paralysis, that sort of stuff, the weight on the chest.
Yeah.
Of course he twists and he squirms and he's trying to escape. Then abruptly the pressure ceased and I became aware of two unblinking fish-white eyes glaring truculently at me through the darkness. And this is where he sits up and he finds that he's bleeding.
Yeah, my fingers encountered a warm wetness, and with a hideous clarity, it was borne in on me that the thing had been feasting on my blood.
Mm. And of course, he doesn't know that this is the god, or this isn't Chaugnafarn at this time. So, rather strangely, he seeks refuge.
Yeah,
with Chaugnafarn, it's almost like he's seeking the thing's protection that has actually just fed on him.
Yeah, I think it's important to mention here that. To get to the cave, he's kind of gone out of his head with thirst and hunger, because he was lost. He was lost in the desert or something, wasn't he, for several days?
Yes.
To the point where he'd had to open a vein and all this. And basically, when he was found by the priest, he was out of his skull.
Mm.
So yeah, I guess this sort of, he's still addled, isn't he?
Yeah.
And he's been told that he's this prophetic kind of chap. And I imagine this addled state of mind, he's gone, well, if, you know, he's my kind of benefactor to a degree, I'll run to him for help.
The protection, yeah, kind of makes sense in that way, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And I forgot about that drinking of his own blood. That's a nice sort of precursor to what happens to him, isn't it? But of course, the throne is empty. Great Chagmar had forsaken its throne. It had descended into the cave and was roaming about in the darkness. In its vampirish explorations, it had stumbled upon my sleeping form and had felled me with its trunk so that it might satisfy its thirst for blood with quick and hideous ferocity. There's nothing of the conventional vampire about this, the seduction.
No.
This is more like, oh, food, eat.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's it.
Well, it's predator-prey stuff right there. And again, it feeds into that lamprey, leech-like thing. You know, leeches and things like that, they're not going to ask you, are they? They're just going to come up and clamp onto your leg and have a good munch, you know?
And at this point, the god returns. And I refuse to dwell on what happened after. I love this description. Were I to tell how the horror began slowly to mount, to recount at length how it heaved its slabby and mucid vastness to the pinnacle of its throne and began nauseatingly to breathe upon me, the slight uncertainty I now entertain as to my sanity would be dispelled in short order. So obviously a sand loss there, and if he if he relives that again, then he's undergoing another sand loss, and quite frankly is on the brink as it is.
yeah he's definitely failed his sand roll, hasn't he?
And it sounds like it's kind of, well, he describes it as his corpse cold hands begin detestably to maul me. There's sort of an implication in this, isn't there?
There is, yeah. It's but again, it's sort of almost like, you know, with the phrasing nursing and things like this, it's almost like a child pouring at its mother's breast kind of thing, isn't that?
Yeah.
It's a very sort of twisted version of that of that maternal thing. Mm. It's deliciously disturbing. I think it's great.
Now, having said that bit is great, in the next bit, we do get the first or maybe even the second indication of what we might call colonialist attitudes, if we were being charitable, I mean, or just downright racist in some senses.
Yes.
He tells the locals what happened.
Yeah.
Chungar is the leader of these people, or the high priest kind of thing, and he recounts these experiences to him.
Well, the priest was an Oxford graduate, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, this is the thing. He says, no doubt you think me a superstitious savage, a ridiculous barbarian. Would it surprise you if I told you I'd spent 8 years in England and I'm a graduate of the University of Oxford? Which comes as a great shock to Allman because, well, we know what the attitude is, don't we?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
But then we get this. It astonishes you, perhaps, that I should have cast my lot with filthy primitives in this loathsome place. And again, this isn't the first example we get of this kind of language, which I suppose is very much of its time and, you know, sort of feeds off of all those tropes of Tarzan and the white savior.
Yeah. What I got from it, because of where it's set and the people that they're discussing, I got a lot of echoes of Sax Roma.
Oh, yes, of course.
The Fu Manchu. But later on, when the journey and things like that, there was very much echoes of that. And that would have been, you know, I mean, that was 1912, wasn't it? The first Fu Manchu serial.
Yeah.
So, and it was a big thing. And it became a big trope, didn't it? It was everywhere.
Yeah, very true. I mean, I'm sure there were lots of stories set around Limehouse in London and kind of stuff.
Well, a lot of the Sherlock Holmes stuff.
Yeah. And Robert E. Howard's Skullface was a very similar setting with the Oriental supervillain. So, yeah, quite a common trope at the time, it seems. But this is where we get now Chagmar Thorne's sort of backstory and his sort of origin story. And about actually, although he's in the East now, many thousands of years ago, he abode with its brothers in a cave in Western Europe, and made from the flesh of toads a race of small dark shapes to serve it. So these are the servitor race you spoke about at the start.
Yeah, which interestingly are given a Latin name, Miri Nigri, which means wondrous dark folk in Latin, because they actually... It was all about Rome, wasn't it? It was around the hills outside Rome and things like that.
Yeah, we're in the Pyrenees, and we get mention of Rome as well. And, well, we get some Roman names or some Latin names later on as well, don't we?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, so this tribe, they're actually a migrant tribe. They're not indigenous to this plateau. They've come from
from the Pyrenees to,
you know,
yeah.
Mm. Yeah, yeah, and made from the flesh of toads.
And yeah, this is where we get this idea that now the god wants to return to the West, and Ormond says, I can't lift it, I can't do this on my own. So this is how he gets the statue across. I will have the guardians assist you, murmured Chungar soothingly. You shall be conveyed in comfort to the gates of Lhasa, and from Lhasa to the coast. It is less than a week's journey by caravan. So he had this terrible journey to get in across the desert, almost dying of starvation and thirst.
Yeah.
But now he's going back in comfort, it seems, accompanied by the elephant god.
Well, yeah, comfort's one way of putting it. Yeah. The thing is, I can't imagine these guardians who were tasked with it were happy about it, because it had mentioned that basically these guys are glad to see the back of old Mr. Thorne,
yeah,
because he's basically been munching on the guardians for months and months and years, hasn't he? He's basically been feeding on them.
You know? Yeah, this is what he does, right? Because we get that earlier. Twice a year, Chaugnar Thorne sent its servants into the villages that dotted the foothills, and we get the chosen youths and maidens were preserved with spices and stored in the cave till Chaugnar had need of them. And this is quite grim as well. In the villages, men would hurl their firstborns into the flames and offer prayers to their futile little gods, hoping thereby to appease the wrath of Chaugnar's mindless servants. So wherever he lives, he's feeding on the local populace, and it almost becomes a ritual, it seems, in some cases. So yeah, it's like they want to get shot.
Yeah. And you also get mentioned here that he came from where he was before, a place called Pompeilo. They call it the doom that came to Pompeilo. I wonder if that was a nod to Lovecraft.
Oh, that's got to be. That's got to be. Isn't it?
Yeah.
You might think that Ormond could just say, yeah, mate, no problems. Yep, I'll do that. Then the minute he's over the horizon, he sort of scoots off. But Chungar approached very close and peered into my eyes. If you attempt to dispose of my god, he warned, its brothers will come down from the mountains and tear you indescribably. Now, that sounds bad enough, because he saw perhaps that I wasn't wholly convinced, for he added in an even more ominous tone, it has laid upon you the mark and seal of the flesh-dissolving sacrament. Destroy it, and the sacrament will be consummated in an instant. The flesh of your body will turn black and melt like tallow in the sun. You will become a seething mass of corruption. So he's got a sort of a curse or a giesh laid on him.
Yeah, and then so basically him and these guardians haul Chaugnar Thorne across continents and, you know, all the rest of it. They take it from Bengal to Hong Kong and all that kind of business. And you get this lovely line here. Don't imagine for a moment that I didn't share their awe and fear of the thing I was compelled to companion. Continuously, I longed to carry it on deck and cast it into the sea. Only the memory of Chungar's warning and the thought of what might happen to me if I disregarded it kept me chained and submissive. And basically, he starts getting a bit hysterical at this point. And this is where he starts discussing the true nature, almost, of Chaugnar Thorne. Because you get this, Chaugnar Thorne is an awful and mysterious being, a repellent and obscene and lethal being. But how do I know that it is omnipotent? And basically, Chungar has explained that he sort of exists on many planes. You know, it's quite mind-bending, really.
It's nice because there are, and we get this section which sort of ties us into the cosmic, and later on we get that idea that we've talked about very often of we are three-dimensional creatures, yeah, and these things are six or seven dimensional, and that idea of the intersection of the two. You know, when you live in a 2D world, you can't imagine a globe, you see it as a flat thing. But what we get here is this idea of different dimensions or different levels of reality, and the idea of some hideous process as yet unobserved by the science of the West may be obnoxiously at work in desert places all over our planet to produce such fiendish anomalies. Perhaps parallel to protoplasmic life on Earth's crust is this other aberrant and hidden life, the revolting sentiency of stones that aspire, that wax agile in the presence of man. So there's a couple of things mixed in with this, isn't it? One, is he like a natural creature and there's some process that we don't know of whereby these things spring into life? But that's immediately followed with, did not Cuvier believe that there had been not one, but an infinite number of creations? So this idea of the parallel universe or the parallel world as well.
Yeah.
And he sort of says, well, whether we accept the planetismal or the three or four newer theories of planetary formation, it's permissible to believe that the Earth coalesced very swiftly into a compact mass. And this is all taking place over billions of years. So we get that sense of the deep time that is obviously a staple of the cosmic horror.
Yeah. I love that it's, he's talking about, you know, evolution and sort of like a parallel evolution, you know, and there's a great line here, non-protoplasmic cycle. Now that sounds like an industrial band.
Yes, there's our first band name. I'm going through my non-protoplasmic cycle. Please do not disturb me. So, yes, we get that discussion about the possible origins of Chalcedon Fauna, one of the possible origins. And this is at the point, as you say, Ullman's getting more and more hysterical. This is where we go full Phantom of the Opera and he uncovers his face.
Oh, what a reveal. This is why I'd love to see an adaptation of this. But I don't want crap CGI. It's got to be a full-on rubber, you know.
Proper Lon Chaney. The man of the thousand faces.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But Algernon is made of stern stuff.
Hmm.
He didn't utter a sound, for all that the sight was appalling enough to revolt a corpse.
Yeah, that's a great line, isn't it?
And he says, look, this is what's happened to me. This is what I've become. So you must believe my story now. You must believe that Chalcedon Fauna has wrought this uncleanliness. But he doesn't. You know, he's saying, well, this is just a statue.
Yeah.
And he thinks basically he's been possibly drugged, his face has been cut, has been mutilated, perhaps he's been hypnotized.
Yeah. Plastic surgery and things like that. Yeah.
Yeah, they talk about that later as well, isn't there? Yeah, yeah. And you're still under hypnosis. But Ullman says, well, when I got on a ship at Calcutta, my face was fine. Yeah, but you know, one of the minions could have drugged you and carried out this operation and that kind of stuff. So he's doing that very typical thing of looking for the rational explanation.
Yeah. I thought there were some interesting parallels here to the narrator's character in Hounds of Tyndalos, because he's very similar. He's just like, oh, stuff of nonsense. You've been duped. It's all charlatanry. It's a very similar kind of thing. I guess that was sort of the attitude of the time, wasn't it? It was all very, especially for these kind of chaps, it was all kind of buttoned down. This is rational. This is real. What you're talking about is fantasy, and therefore I'm not going to entertain it, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, especially when it's tied in with those colonial and racist attitudes. Yeah. Where what was that quote in Hounds of Tyndalos? He basically dismisses 3,000 years of Taoist thought as a load of old rot, wasn't it, or something?
Well, like I think it was rot. Yeah, load of old rot. Yeah.
Some of the finest brains that ever, you know. Right, so that gets us into Chapter 2, The Atrocity at the Museum. As you say, another great story. And this is where we get another character introduced. And this is Dr. George Francis Scollard, who Harris sort of bumps into on the bus.
Yeah, and they sort of meet up on the way to the museum and they're discussing the autopsy, because poor old Ullman, you know, whipped himself up into such a lather that he had basically a seizure, didn't he, and dropped dead.
Yes, and they're putting it down to heart attack, or the verdict is heart attack. The coroner was very positive that anxiety and shock were the sole cause of Ullman's total collapse. But you said something about his face being horribly disfigured. And this is where, is it? Yeah, but that was plastic surgery. That's all that was. He'd fallen into the hands of a skillful Oriental surgeon with sadistic inclination. That's a nice phrase, sadistic inclination.
This is another band name. That for a goth band this time, sadistic inclination.
We get this little discussion about, well, could this really have been done? And we get some talk about plastic surgery. And I thought, on the one hand, this was quite poignant given the time, because we're still just post-World War One. where obviously a lot of people came back horribly disfigured, and there was a that sort of whole wax mask thing going on, and I guess early attempts at reconstructive surgery. So there's that aspect to it. But then there was this line as well, which I thought I probably shouldn't name anyone in particular, but I'm sure we can all think of certain celebrities. When one stops to consider what astounding advances plastic surgery has made in England, America during the past decade, it is impossible to disbelieve that the human frame will soon become more malleable than wax beneath the scalpels of our surgeons, and that beings will appear in our midst with bodies so grotesquely distorted that the superstitious will ascribe their advent to the supernatural. That's quite prescient, isn't it?
Yeah, that's actually really kind of, yeah. Well, again, Long has this gift for sort of prophetic statements like that, because you had all this stuff about, like, he basically prophesized the psychedelic movement in the Hounds of Tyndalos, didn't he? It was sort of like, that was very 60s feeling. And, yeah.
It's very trippy, wasn't it? Yeah, that scene in the story. Yeah. So that's one theory. We've got another theory that possibly something to do with glands. You know, if you have an imbalance in your glands, then that can create certain changes in the body.
Yes.
And we get this mention of acromegaly. It's characterized by an abnormal overgrowth of the skull and face and the small bones of the extremities, and its victims become in short time tragic caricatures of humanity. Now, I don't know about tragic caricatures, but, you know, it certainly does give people a striking appearance. And of course, there are a number of very famous examples. So people like Andre the Giant, Fred Gwynne, who played Herman Munster.
Yeah.
And almost like a parallel to that, Ted Cassidy, who played Lurch.
Yeah.
Who was about 7 foot tall or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, you've got, I mean, like now you've got the wrestler Paul White, the Big Show, who's like 7 foot something tall.
Wow.
And 500 odd pounds. And yeah, he's a big boy. The great Khali, the famous Indian wrestler as well, who's sort of, he's getting on near 8 foot tall. He's enormous, that chap.
So yeah. I suppose certainly back in those days, and I mean, to tie this in with a bit of a pun, a slightly distasteful pun, the Elephant Man, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I can't remember the exact condition he had, but obviously those terrible deformities. And of course, at that time, that was enough to put you in the sideshow, right? The freak show.
Well, wasn't Merrick locked up in an asylum?
Well, again, that's that very Victorian or Edwardian idea that what is on the outside reflects what's on the inside. So
exactly, yeah, it's like, yeah, like them disappointment rooms and things like that, yes. Where, you know, if a child had a deformity, they'd lock them away in the attic, kind of thing. Is really horrible. Think about it.
It's grim, isn't it? It is so grim and so sad. So they're talking about this, and they get to the museum, and there's a big crowd in front of the museum. And there's press, and there's a police. And I like this little bit. This was a nice little touch. What I like about Long is he puts in these little things that don't really need to be there. They're not anything to do with the plot, but they just flesh out the characters a little more. His pessimism proved well-founded. The bus continued relentlessly on its way for four additional blocks, and then came so abruptly to a stop that Dr. Scollard was subjected to the ignominy of being obliged to sit for an instant on the spacious lap of a middle-aged stout woman who resented the encroachment with a furious glare.
See, that's the thing. That's the sort of thing that I put in my stories. It's those moments of humour, I think, really act as a really good counterpoint to the horrific.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's sort of peaks and troughs. It's almost like, I see it almost like music. You know, you've got to have your light moments and your dark moments and your all that. If it's all one note, it gets a bit dull, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, that's it, and it grounds it in everyday life, because we've just had this talk of dimensions and planets and all the rest of it, and then suddenly, you know, you can be having this highfalutin conversation, the bus driver slams the brakes on, And you sat on someone's lap, probably getting a slap round the face, you know.
Something almost carry on about it, isn't there? In fact, I think that actually happens to Sid James in one of them, doesn't it? Oh no, it's Bernard Breslau in Carry On Girls on the train, where he ends up in somebody's bosom.
Wah, 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 wah.
Yeah. And he gets one of them delightful slaps around the face, you know.
So this gets them to the museum, and they almost can't get into the museum because the police guy, the policeman on guard, the red-headed policeman, glared savagely at them from behind horn-rimmed spectacles. You've got to keep out. If you ain't got a police card, you've got to keep out. Guy's been bumped off. You can't come in. And, of course, Algernon gets his card out and says, yeah, actually, I'm the curator here. So you can do one.
The officer's manner softened perceptibly. I bet it did. Shut your mouth, you've got jobs worth, you know.
So there's been another murder. And
yes, Taggart.
yes. As the attendant tells them, the first we knew of it was when Mr. Williams came running down the stairs with his hands all bloodied. And Williams usually arrives early, and he goes and has a chat with Cine, who I guess was the sort of night watchman.
Mm.
And he goes to have a chat with Cine, but, well, something's happened to Cine.
I thought this was a beautiful touch here. It's, again, like what you're saying about just these little touches. I was the only one to see him come down the stairs. I was standing about here, and as soon as he came into sight, I knew something was wrong with him. He went from side to side of the stairs and clung to the rails to keep himself from falling. I can see that. Yeah. I can picture that. Then one of, you know, he's weaving down the things. Oh, you know.
And again, it's very true to life, isn't it? I mean, Lovecraft has people fainting a lot, but this seems more realistic to me in that sense. And, of course, they ask, what's wrong, Jim? What did you see? And we get this nice line, the worm of hell, the devil's awful mascot, and other things I can't repeat. I'm a God-fearing man, and there are blasphemies it's best to forget you ever heard. Sin is upstairs, stretched out on his back, and there ain't a drop of blood in his veins.
Nice.
So Sin is not just dead, he's worse than dead. All black and shrunken, and his face was gone, all eaten away. So, quite a grim discovery. And what is the what's the first thing that comes into mind is must be some sort of maniac with a knife.
Yeah.
And then the second thing that comes to mind was, well, it was obviously Chinese or Hindu chap, which I'm not quite sure where that comes from.
Dudes of the era, I guess. Yeah. Sadly.
Yeah. But, yeah. And this idea of the Chinaman, we've got to get hold of the Chinaman, takes quick root, and suddenly everyone's looking for the a sort of Chinaman with a big knife or something. It's quite interesting. It's almost like the mob mentality, isn't it? You see in Frankenstein and stuff.
Yeah. It's to the point of parody, really. I mean, it's, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Perhaps he is parodying those views. I mean, could be.
That's what I get from it. It's reductio ad absurdum, isn't it? It's...
Yeah.
Taking it to the point where it becomes absurd. And I mean, that's how I picture it in my head. Whether that was the intention or not, I don't know, but that's how I sort of see it.
But then we get the source of this theory, because the detective says, well, it must have been someone like that, or maybe Japanese person or South Sea Islanders, because we found rice. And it's this is an odd little detail. There's a rice bowl with chopsticks up in, I like this, Alcove K. There's another band name. That's probably a kind of new wavy type band.
I was just thinking about Alcove K. That would be a great name for a band, wouldn't it? Yeah.
And they found this wooden bowl and the two chopsticks, and there's bloodstains all around the rim of the bowl. And even the rice is all smeared with blood. Where did you find it? The president spoke in a subdued whisper. On the floor in front of the big stone elephant. That's where Cine was killed. There's blood all over the elephant, if it's supposed to be an elephant. that was a nice one.
Yeah.
So this kind of confused me a little bit, because what's the connection with the rice, do you think?
Well, actually, I think it's because they get this guy, don't they? And I think it's he's a prophet. So I think he'd gone to commune.
Right.
I mean, how I see it is, this guy's a prophet. He's been having dreams. So he's gone there and he's basically doing a vigil. He's sitting there talking to his God while he's having his dinner, sort of thing. And then Sinny probably appeared and said, "Oi, what are you doing in the museum? It's closed. Get out or I'll give you a slap." And bang, your lunch, mate.
Well, yeah, we get this because they get this guy, right, who names himself as Xie Ho, and we get this sort of broken English kind of stereotypical thing.
Yeah.
You're a very good man. I saw you in Green Fire Dream. In Dream, big green animals come down from a mountain. I saw you and Gautama Siddhartha, who's the Buddha. Big green animals all wanted blood. In the dream, Gautama Siddhartha said, "They want you. They have determined to make you all dark fire glue."
Dark Fire Glue.
Album name.
Yeah.
And it's almost like he was told to go to the museum and sacrifice himself to Chowgna Fawn in order to prevent something worse that was going to happen.
Yeah. Well, then old Sidney got in the way, pretty much. Probably, again, being a jobsworth and sticking his nose in where it weren't wanted. You know? So if he just let the chap finish his rice and do what he needed to do, he'd have been fine. Yeah,
all of that could have been avoided.
Yeah.
And of course, he talks about the elephant statue coming to life and everything else, which isn't going to do his case any goodness, no. It, really. Put the bracelets on him, Jim. The bracelets.
Again, it's those touches. Like, that's a line that Lovecraft would never have written.
Yes, yes. It's too vernacular, isn't it, for Lovecraft in that sense.
Indeed.
But then we get a touch of the Smith as well.
Mm.
Because Algernon says, I think this guy is a witness. You know, his story sounds incredible. But this line, but he's as destitute of criminal proclivities as Dr. Scollard here. Criminal proclivities.
I like it.
And a detective obviously thinks this is all nonsense, but there's something about Algernon, the authority in his voice that, you know, he sort of goes along with this. And then we get this this other nice phrase, sanguinary baptism becomes some gods.
Sanguinary baptism. Now, there is a goth band.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is, isn't it? That is. And this is where they look at the statue and start seeing the bloodstains and everything else on it.
Yeah.
And this is where Algernon makes his spot hidden role, because he notices that the trunk of the statue is in a different position. It's moved its trunk, and most hideously, I cannot be mistaken. Yesterday it was vertical. Today it is in a slightly upraised position. And this is where we get our next character drawn in. Dr. Henry C. Imbert, FRS, FAGS. I've got no idea what either of those stand for. Fellow of something? Fellow.
I was going to say Fellow of Research Society or something. Or
Royal Society.
Royal Society. For Fellow of the Royal Society? Yeah, probably.
So this guy is, well, we get the introduction to him next time, but it's suggested to the detective that they bring Imbert in on the investigation because he has experience in these strange and weird matters.
Yeah, he's a foremost American ethnologist. There we go.
That gets us into Chapter 3, an archaeological digression.
Yeah, this is basically Dr. Imbert is basically going, having a look at the statue, and a lot of it is just talking about possible origins of the statue and all that. But there's a really interesting point that I thought here, and it was about the evolution of these kind of statues and things like this, is that say a great stone magna mater with arms outstretched to embrace all classes and conditions of men, then let us suppose that the cooperative agriculture fails into disrepute, falls into disrepute, and the tribe becomes obsessed by dreams of martial conquest. What happens? They put a spear in the hands of the thing and it becomes a war god. I thought that was a really interesting observation. You know, it's
and I think that's something I'm sure experts in the field can do, that you can trace the evolution of gods. I mean, you go right the way back to the Babylonians, I guess, and that kind of stuff. Well, and I suppose it's certain tropes. I mean, people talk about Mithra and Jesus and those kind of things as well, and the parallels even with Egyptian gods. You know, I suppose part of it is there are only so many stories to tell So there's only so many origin stories, but it is interesting to see how these deities develop.
Yeah.
But we do get slightly let down again with some of the language here. And again, we might be charitable to Long and say, well, this is the professor saying this and not him.
Mm-hmm.
There's also this idea that as well as evolution, we have devolution within humans, and they become degraded objects of worship in certain, well, again, what they would call primitive societies.
Yeah.
In fact, it's probably the reverse. They're probably much closer to the origins of those deities than now. I don't know. Again, that's something of the time,
yeah.
That idea of the superiority of civilization, I guess.
And again, it's like it's that very American sort of capitalist thinking, and obviously the British colonial as well. You know, it's all a hangover of that, isn't it? It's
which kind of ties in with that theft of all the artifacts, isn't it? Because
yeah,
you know, we're going to take this, yeah, but this is our sacred. Well, yeah, but we don't care because you're just primitive, and we know better than you.
Yeah.
You haven't even got a flag.
Yeah, know? I was going to say, yeah. What do you care? We own this now because we put a flag in that hill.
No, none of you are even wearing tweed
or a tie pin. Not a tie pin amongst you. Yeah.
So, there's a suggestion from Dr. Imbert. He doesn't think he can really help this. Transcends all of his experience, but he knows a man who can, a recluse, a psychic, a magnificent intellect obsessed by mysteries and mysticism. I put little faith in such things. To me, it's degradation, but I'll take you to him. And this guy's name is Roger Little, and he used to be a criminal investigator, a psychologist, and no mere detective novel sleuth. Which I wonder if that was a dig at anyone or something. I don't know.
Yeah. It's a dig at Mr. Conan Doyle, maybe. Yeah. But, I definitely get the echoes of Carnacki in this chap.
Yes, he's a very strange character, actually.
Mm.
And before we get to him, we get this brief interlude, a very short chapter, The Horror on the Hills, which is a news item about a hideous massacre in the Pyrenees, where a 14 bodies were found, all laid in a row, very silent and pale, beneath a soft Spanish sky, all naked, and all without their heads. And around them were footprints a yard wide. And that's... and they all drained of blood as well. And that's all we get. That's all we get of that. And then we're back into the story. It's quite interesting how he drops
that in. Yeah, I love it when authors do that kind of thing. Especially because you go from that last chapter, which is quite hard going. It's quite heavy going because there's a lot of archaeological terminology even, and all that kind of stuff. You know, it's quite scientific. So it's nice to get that this little, I was going to say light relief, but it's anything but light relief.
Yeah, yeah. So they go to see this Roger Little, or in my mind is now Little Roger. I can't help it. It's just the way I think. And we get a lot of this guy's background and a lot of his theories about the occult, about how he's a quester, about how he has psychic visions. And to be honest, I thought he was a bit of an arsehole.
He is a bit. But again, it's that Sherlockian, Carnackian, aloof superiority thing, isn't it, that these occult detectives all seem to have? They're all a bit of a dick, you know. One thing I just want to point out very quickly is where Roger Little, that is got to be a carry-on character. Roger Little, I like to Roger a lot, you know.
Very good. He does have a nice turn of phrase, though. I mean, straight away, yeah. He's on with, I've written books, many books, dozens of, you know, he's quite full of himself.
Yeah.
And quite theatrical as well. I can almost imagine him speaking in this kind of voice, you know. But what I've experienced in this very room is no more than a flickering shadow, swift passing and obscurely glimpse of the horror that lurks godlessly in undimensioned space. In my dreams, I have heard the nauseous piping of its glutinous flutes. Now, that's a good one, isn't it? Glutinous flutes.
Yeah, that's a Lovecraftian homage right there, isn't it? It's got to be.
So Mr. Little gets points for that.
Yeah.
And he's basically telling them how great he is.
He does spend a lot of time saying what he's been doing, and basically he's rattling on. I can imagine Algernon's getting a bit cheesed off with him. They're just like, I'll get to the point. But and he only really shuts up when Algernon drops in the name Chorgnathorn.
Yes. Yeah, he's not really taking him seriously, is he, up to that point? He thinks, oh, someone's been murdered, so what, big deal? You know, what was that? I've seen ion beams off the new bit of Saturn landing, or whatever that quote. I've just mangled that quote.
Like tears in rain.
Yeah.
The old Blade Runner quote. Yeah. Ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion.
That's it. That's the one. That's the chap. Yeah, and then we get at the mention of the name, he actually shuts up, and his voice sinks to a whisper, and then he tells them about a dream he had last Halloween. And basically, he dreamt he was a Roman, Callius Rufus, a provincial quaestor, and we're in the Pyrenees, we're in Pompeo.
Yeah.
And of course, we get this whole experience of the strange race of small, dark people who live in the hills, the terrible rites and practices that they carry out, fires on the hilltops, the strange drums, and the people who go missing, it's thought for sacrificial purposes.
Clearly, they must have reserved the town for some terrible doom, which they would call down on their unholy Sabbath night, as they drummed and howled and danced outrageously on the mountain's crest. Lovely.
And then we get this whole story, which really is a story within a story.
Yeah.
Of how they take a unit of Romans from the local legion and go marching up into the hills to confront these horrible people and stamp out, because Rome doesn't like that sort of thing going on in its territories, does it?
You know, of course not.
Only Rome's allowed to slaughter people.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, you had all the different cults and everything as well, didn't you? So it's like you don't worship the right god.
I was thinking of what they did to the Druids, for example, and all that kind of stuff.
But interestingly, when you said it's like a story within a story, because I'd read The Horror from the Hills, I think I first read it quite a while ago, and I actually thought that this bit was a separate story.
Yeah,
I thought it was a different story. I thought The Horror from the Hills was just the museum stuff and all that. I forgot that this Roman interlude was actually part of this and not a separate story.
Oh, totally. I think I was the same. Yeah, in my mind, I had museum statue coming to life, and I'd totally forgotten this as well. Yeah.
Yeah, because as I mentioned earlier, it had an earlier name, the Elephant God of Leng. He later did a poem and called it the Elephant God of Leng. So I thought this Roman thing was called the Elephant God of Leng. There you go.
So basically what happens is they go marching up there, pandemonium breaks out, the sky is snuffed out, the stars disappear, which is a nice touch. The horses that they'd sort of tethered down in the forest below start screaming. There's drums, cackling laughter, a cold wind, and then we get the sight of these elephantine creatures. The Mirinigri had called their terrible gods out of the void.
Yeah, and that's where he wakes up, isn't it?
Yeah. So given all this, and with the appearance of Chorgnathorn in the west, he sees this as some monstrous unfettering is about to take place. That which for 2,000 years has lain somnolent will stir again, and the great things will descend from their frightful lair on the Spanish hills, drawn cityward through the will of Chorgnathorn. So this seems to be the grand plan now. He's going to awaken his kin, and he's going to unleash them on civilization.
Yeah. And it turns out that the priest he'd said he would have his prophets, and Roger Little and the little Chinese chap, they're obviously the prophets. And there we go. Yeah, it's all in place. It's like all the pieces are on the chessboard.
And it's at this point of tension, the telephone rings. And it's the museum, the Manhattan Museum, calling for Algernon. And they get the news that Chorgnathorn has left the museum.
Yeah.
Chorgnathorn has left the building. And
it's brilliant.
No one saw him go, and the idiot who phoned thinks that a thief removed him, or possibly one of the attendants. Like, surely that would be the most sensible thing to think of. Someone's stolen the statue, not that it got up and walked off by itself. Bit unfair on that guy, I think.
They have kind of said that it was it's bulky. It'd have to be maybe it was Andre the Giant. He could have done it.
There you go. So Little comes up. He's got a solution to all this. Don't worry. Come into my lab.
Late one night.
I'll show you something which should restore your confidence in the experimental capacity of the human mind when there is but one choice confronting it. To survive or go down forever into everlasting night of darkness. And that brings us into chapter 6, The Time-Space Machine.
Love it. Yeah. And this is where the Carnacki things come into my head. You know, you get all those things in Carnacki stories where he's waffling on about his electric pentangle and his vacuum circles and all this kind of stuff. And you get a lot of that here. There's a lot of like pseudo-technical techno-babble, isn't there? It's delicious. It's so well done as well.
It's that lovely kind of Jules Verne type stuff, isn't it? Like we've spoken about before, almost sort of steampunky.
Yeah.
In it's futuristic, but at the same time, it's all large spheres and crescents and sparks flying and big levers and all that kind of stuff. Isn't it?
There's a lot of globes in one of these. It's my editor brain. You know, you train yourself to look for repeated words in certain paragraphs, right? You know that editing thing. You got a lot of globes here. You got great bluish globes, half globes, quarter globes, globes that sprouted at grotesque angles. Yeah, it's a globe fest.
And when he switches it on, this all gradually, it spins and whirs, and it gradually sort of merges into one shape, which is described as a spheroid with a non-Euclidean face, a geometric blasphemy that was at once isosceles and equilateral, convex and concave.
Nice.
You are looking on a fourth dimensional figure, said Little soothingly. Steady now.
You could play Lovecraftian bingo with this story, couldn't you? We've had Cyclopean, we've had non-Euclidean. We've got Bulbous and Bestial on the other page there.
Yeah, we've got glutinous flutes.
Glutinous flutes, yeah.
And mucoid as well.
Oh, nice. Or protoplasm.
So then we get into Einsteinian physics and this idea, again, of fourth dimensional things in a three dimensional world and five dimensional things, etc., etc. And again, the cosmic nature comes in here. Now this goes beyond just the monster story. Again, the sequence in which we view events in nature is not a cosmic actuality, and our conviction that we are going somewhere in time is a purely human illusion conditioned by our existence on this particular planet and the limitations which our five senses impose upon us. So pure Lovecraftian.
Yeah. You're basically going into thermodynamics here because you've got talk of entropy, which is the main crux of this, isn't it? It's to try and impose, to force entropy upon Chorgna Thorn, isn't it? It's
yes. I mean, in shorthand terms, it's got a sort of machine that emits a ray that creates entropy and decay, and Chorgna Thorn should be susceptible to this.
It's very Doctor Who. It's very, very Doctor Who.
Yeah, I never thought of that.
Yeah, I could tell you several stories that include rays that could age people to death, and it's like the whole the trilogy that was the end of Tom Baker's tenure, specifically the story Legopolis, is all about entropy, and it's about the heat death of the universe and kind of stuff. Yeah. So I got real echoes of that. From this,
yeah, because there's mention here of planets being born from star wombs, it's entropy that cools great orbs hotter than Betelgeuse, more fiery than Arcturus, through all the outer vastness, reducing them to sterility, to whirling motes of chaos. So yes, this is what they're going to lug out of the laboratory and go in search of Chorgna Thorn with.
Yeah.
But this goes, say we've got Einstein here, he's talking about Poe and Blake. There's so many different aspects to this. You could spend a lot of time even just on this chapter going down all these rabbit holes. Yeah.
That's it. If we had time, we could do an entire episode on this chapter, just going off in all the different tangents from it. It's Whether anyone would want to listen to it is another matter, but
and whether we're suitably qualified to talk about Einstein, I severely doubt.
I'm not. I know I'm not.
Some days I struggle to work the remote control. But,
yeah, I can talk about Doctor Who, but Einstein now.
So, Chapter 7, A Cure for Skepticism.
I love this. This is the comedy interlude, pretty much, isn't it?
It is. It's a short chapter again, and it just takes us out of the action and gives us a little, a little sort of giggle almost, isn't it?
Yeah.
So we learn there's been some deaths. There's been 5 emergency calls because of now, of course, they're listening out for news. Chandler Fawn has gone. Where's he gone? He's going to be doing something. All horribly mutilated. The people are going wild. No one knows what's happening. What can we do about it? And Algernon just says, the machine.
Yeah.
And the response to that is, well, Imbert says, you do know that Little's mentally unbalanced.
Yeah, he's a loon. So,
but you introduced him in the first place. You recommended him. And he says, it's just a mechanical hypnotizer.
Group hypnotism. All that. So, yeah, Algernon gets a bit cheesed off, really. He goes, well, I'll convince you that I wasn't hypnotized, and turns it on. Basically vaporizes the wall, doesn't it?
Yes, deliberately he walked to the machine and shot the lever upward. Then this weird, because we're then straight into Chapter 8, which is, that's almost like one of those endings of an episode, isn't it? You see him switch. Yeah, he switches he pulls the lever down.
Yeah.
And credits, and then we start next time with them all staring at this big hole in the wall.
Yeah.
Through which the skyline of Lower Manhattan glimmered nebulously. Little doesn't seem too upset by this, despite the fact there's now a big hole in the wall of his apartment. He seems to think it's quite good.
This is just a bit of a lark, doesn't it? I love that lark. This line here is just like, oh well, you know, the landlord will fix it, it's fine. Just imagine, you know, it's like I've lived in rented accommodation my whole life. You go and ask the landlord for a light bulb, and if you want to tell him that there's a bloody great hole in the wall.
And there's more killing going on. In fact, there's been a massacre on the Jersey coast near Asbury Park. Everyone's rushing around. There seems to be like panic in the streets. Mm. And there's been similar massacre in Spain as well. So obviously this is the brothers are now waking up and are on the move. And Little is quite insistent that they should go out and sort this out now, because the longer this goes on, the more panic there'll be. There'll be blind terror, there'll be acts of violence, hundreds of people will run amok, pillage, destroy. That's kind of interesting, because that's civilized people, right? You know, there's that interesting contrast there between these primitives who have lived with this thing for however many years, and as soon as a civilized person does it, they go berserk and run amok and start killing each other. That's quite...
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Yeah. So basically they pack it up into the car and decide to go and hunt the elephant god, don't they?
Yes. Chapter 9, The Horror Moves. Yeah. And I was thinking here of the Dunwich Horror.
Yeah.
The last scene of hunting the twin down.
Yeah.
With the powder of Ibn Ghazi and a shotgun and an old book.
Yeah. the barn that's got a great big slug trail through the middle of it. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not sure what the timing is on that. When was the Dunwich Horror? Got to be about the same time. I've got an inkling it was 32, maybe. But
written in 1928 and published in 1929.
Oh, right. So I have to wonder then if Long drew inspiration from that, because this next scene is quite similar in the sense of tracking a hideous monster across country. And almost following, like that said, you can imagine that big wide trail of destruction and chaos and madness in its wake.
Yeah, people running amok, and then you've got a trail of bloodless, headless corpses, basically, in this one, haven't you?
Mm. And old Chowdhury is heading into the marshes, and so they follow him in. They get the beam on him for a little bit, and it doesn't seem to do too much, and Little explains, well, no, we've got to sort of keep him in the beam for... much longer than that, for many minutes. To send it back, we must decrease the random element in it by a billion years.
Blimey. Again, that's that sense of age with it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because you've got this this brilliant bit when they do corner it and they shoot this light on it, and he's basically out sort of in the shadows of a deserted bathhouse, and then this bathhouse basically crumbles to dust, and old Chalk the decider goes, "Is that the best you can do?" I got him in Scottish, Billy Connolly Scottish accent. "Is that the best you can do?" You know. Maybe Chalk is a Glaswegian, you know. "Best you can do, pal."
And they get a break here, they get a bit of luck, because Chalkner's out wading through this marsh and he gets stuck in the mud, which is rather fortuitous.
Mm.
So that gives them the opportunity to zap him with the beam, and is sort of effectively pinned in place. So then we get this nice description of the ending of Chalkner form.
Yep.
And it is that sort of devolution, I suppose, from beast shape to jelly, a jelly enveloped in darting filaments of corpse pale flame. But then we also get this this almost apparition appears above as well.
Yeah.
Which was interesting. It was almost like the spirit of him or the ghost of him sort of comes up above, and then that gradually fades away.
Well, you have those theories that ghosts and ghost sightings are trans-dimensional beings.
Yes, of course. That, yeah.
You know, so I got that kind of echo. It all ties into that many worlds theory that's sort of going on in this story.
Yeah. And then we get an explanation in chapter 10, Little's explanation, because the question is, do you think that last manifestation was a kind of spectral emanation without physical substance? And Little says, well, not wholly, because an old odour of putrefaction came from it. I should regard the phenomenon as a kind of tenuous reassembling rather than apparition in a strict sense. Chalkner had been incarnate for so long in the hideous shape with which we are familiar that its disembodied intelligence could reclothe itself in a kind of porous mimesis before it returned to its hyperdimensional sphere. And he does go on as well. So there's quite detailed explanations. This is interesting, because one thing with the cosmic tale generally is you get no explanation,
yeah,
or virtually nothing. This is all quite detailed all the way through.
Yeah, well, you notice that with a lot of long stories, because again, there's quite an emphasis on mathematics and proper science. You know,
yeah.
I mean, you saw that in Hounds of Tyndalos. There was a lot of like geometry and mathematics, and you get that in here as well, which gives it a real grounding, really.
And of course, once Chalkner's gone, all his little buddies in the Pyrenees go as well. There's just little pools of black slime left of those. So basically, they've saved the world.
Well, there's a caveat. It's they've saved the world for now.
Yes. Again, very Lovecraftian.
Yeah. Because they're hyper-dimensionally joined, like Siamese twins. And if one of them was destroyed by a machine similar to the one we used against Chalkner Faun, the other would suffer effacement at the same instant, even though he's on the opposite side of the world. So that's basically explains what happened to all Chalkner's little buddies. But, you know, this is the point. They've only sent him back to a certain point.
And this is like, there's a big parallel with Cthulhu here, isn't there? When Cthulhu rises and then it's not quite the right time, but he's sent back down. But he sends out messages in dreams.
Yeah.
And here we get almost this exact same thing. Chalkner may return. Its return will be presaged in dreams, for when its brethren stirred restlessly on the Spanish hills, both I and Xie-Ho were disturbed in our sleep by harbingers from beyond.
Yeah.
Another bad name. Telepathically, Chalkner spoke to sleeping minds, and if it returns, we'll speak again. For man is not isolated among the sentient beings of the earth, but is linked to all that moves in hyperdimensional continuity.
Brilliant.
There we go. So that's the sort of foreboding end, although, yeah, it is that, exactly that. Oh, we've killed it. In your conventional film, that'd be it.
Yeah.
Let's go and have a cup of tea. But no, there's always that opening for the return of.
There's all that streak of nihilism. It's like, yeah, despite your best efforts, we're still fucked.
you just put it off for a little bit, that's all.
Yeah, you haven't averted the inevitable, just merely delayed it. Mm.
So there we are, a lengthy story, and you know, we've skimmed over a lot of detail there, because there's a huge amount, as we said earlier, we could rabbit hole left, right and centre on this one. Yeah. But definitely recommend a read of this. And to me, there was a Call of Cthulhu scenario called The Curse of Chalgnathorn. It was in the book Curse of the Chthonians, which I guess was quite an early Chaosium one.
Yeah.
And from what I remember, I might still have the book actually, it was very much set around the museum and that kind of aspect of it. It's quite a detailed scenario and a good one to play from what I remember.
Nice. Yeah, there's quite a lot of expansions on old Chaugner in this Tyndalos cycle, because I mean the first sort of 10 or 11 stories are sort of concerned with the Hounds, and then the second 10 are concerned with old Chaugner. So yeah, like we said, you've got the elephant god of Leng, you've got But It's a Long Dark Road by Joseph Pulver Sr. You've got a whole bunch of things. You've got a couple of really good poems from Anke Schwede, Pompeo's Doom and Confession of the White Acolyte. They're all sort of expansions on that story, which is really interesting to read. Yeah. Well, yeah, this book is worth picking up for Bloch's Death is an Elephant.
So, I just love that title.
It's quite a rare one. It's one that's you don't see in
I never heard of it. I never heard of it.
No, well, interestingly, the editor had mentioned, because he was the same editor who did the Mysteries of the Worm, the collection of Bloch's mythos stories for Chaosium. It actually says in the introduction to this is, I can't believe I forgot about this. And it was actually Richard Tierney who pointed it out, who actually said, dude, you've missed out Death is an Elephant. What are you thinking?
Wow. And there is, after the story in this, in the Wildside Press edition, there is a poem from Long, When Chalgnar Wakes. It's not that long. I won't read it now. Perhaps we'll put that up in Innsmouth News or something. But a billion miles beyond the suns which gild the edge of space, great Chalgnar dreams, and there is hate and fury on its face. So a very nice little poem there. So again, yeah, I'd recommend this collection. There's two collections for your list, dear listener.
definitely. Well, yeah.
Now, the other thing I wanted to talk about was the elephant in the room.
You had to, didn't you?
I had to. Or more accurately, the elephant in the tower.
Ah.
Because, of course, as a big Conan fan, my immediate thought on reading this story was the Tower of the Elephant. To my mind, one of the greatest sword and sorcery stories ever written. And, of course, that features Yag Koshar, who's is an alien from another planet, basically, in elephant-like form. I won't say, if you haven't read the story, then I won't say any more than that. But the description is quite similar.
What's he called again?
Yag Kosher.
Yag Kosher, not Sarg Nosher.
There you know where that came from.
I know where that, yeah. I knew at the time. Yeah. Sorry, that's another reference to the Nokinomicon there.
Yes, I wrote a story for the Nokinomicon called the Tower of the Toad, which is Colon the Barbarian. You can get the Nokinomicon and you can read it for yourself, and then
especially a parody, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, I had a lot of fun with that.
Yeah,
but that was March 1933. That was in Weird Tales, so I'm not sure exactly when it was written, but it was certainly published a couple of years after this. So again, how much did Howard draw on this story? I presume he would have been aware of it, because obviously being part of the Lovecraft circle.
Well, all the stories did the rounds, didn't they? Yeah.
So it's interesting to speculate. You have these two similar looking characters in a way, but very different in personalities, because Yag Kosher is quite a sympathetic character. And that's one of the strengths of that story, is Conan's sympathy for this being that's been imprisoned and tortured. So, yes, I just wanted to point that out. I don't know if there's any other elephant monsters we can think of.
No.
Nothing else really springs to
I'm
mind.
just trying to think. It's like, because usually there's been something in Doctor Who, but I don't think there's been an elephant monster in Doctor Who. Not off the top of my head.
I mean, there was that big raft of sort of creature features
Yeah.
or animal after Jaws, wasn't there? Then you had bees and rats and bats and piranhas, and I don't think anyone ever did elephants.
Sharknado. Yeah.
Sharknado, I know.
My favorite was Mega Shark versus Giant Octopus.
Oh, there you go. There you go. I paid to see
With Debbie
that
Gibson in it. It was awful, but
fight.
I went to see it at the cinema. I had to. It was a giant octopus.
Yeah, but was it a craptastic? Was it one of those?
Oh, it's amazing. And I deliberately chose a cinema that had a bar because I thought, if I'm going to enjoy this properly, I'm going to have to get there early. I'm going to get me nachos. I'm going to get a couple of pints down my neck.
Get wankered first, and then you're like, absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Used to take a rucksack to the cinema because when I lived above a pub, there was a big cinema multiplex down the road. It was like a 2 minute walk. So me and the barman used to fill up our rucksacks of bottles of Newcastle Brown Ale and bags of crisps, and we'd go down and we'd catch the midnight horror movies. And they had a House of the Dead down there, the light gun shooter. We used to just get pissed. It was just something to do on weeknights.
But it's very rare. There's a cinema in Cambridge we went to. I think we saw the second Lord of the Rings there. And that was like when I say adult cinema, don't take that the wrong way. But it was like, they had comfy seats and there's a bar and you can take your drink into the theater rather than being the places. I mean, they have improved. I think your
Oh,
general, your Cineplexes have improved. Back in the day, you were really crammed in
oh, they
and,
were horrible. Yeah.
people smoking and all that kind of stuff.
They were all in like old bingo halls, weren't they? They're all horrible.
Yeah, horrible wooden seats and like. So there we are. I see the Arkham bus has just pulled up outside, so it's time for us to bid another farewell to foggy Innsmouth. I say it's warmed up a little bit here. It's not quite as cold as it was on our last visit.
Spring is in the air, and you can hear the sound of mating shoggoths
Oh,
at
that's neither a sound I care to hear nor an image I care to think of.
That means we need to. Oh, that reminds me, we need to cover Shoggoths in Bloom by Elizabeth Blair. Elizabeth Bear.
Okay, we'll put that on the list. And yeah, what we'll do, well, next time we've got another guest coming in, I believe, to the Innsmouth Hotel for us to chat to. And that's Alexandra Beaumont, who's a folklorist and author. We're looking forward to chatting to her, especially about how folklore kind of crosses over with Lovecraft in a lot of places as well.
Awesome.
That would be interesting.
Awesome. Isn't she a guest, going to be one of our guests at the Innsmouth Literary Festival?
She is indeed. She
There's another cheap
well
plug.
plugged, sir. Well plugged. If nothing else, we're good at plugging our own stuff. Yes, she's going to be a guest there, so you'll be able to meet her and chat with her there. And of course, we'll be on the panels as well. We're looking to have a few panels. One's going to be talking about weird tales, and there'll probably be like an open Q&A session with the authors as well as all the other great things we've got going on. So, just time quickly to say thank you to all our new subscribers to the YouTube channel, to our patrons, and I particularly want to say thank you to Mark Jenkins, a new patron. And Mark was instrumental in setting up of the Innsmouth Book Club. In fact, it was largely his idea some years ago. So, thanks, Mark. Welcome aboard.
Cheers, Mark.
And I think he's coming up to the festival as well, or is trying to arrange it to come up. So it'd be great to see Mark again. Thanks to all our other patrons, of course. And if you'd care to join them, do check out our Patreon site, as well as bonus content for the Innsmouth Book Club. You get bonus content for Strange Shadows. You get a regular copy of Innsmouth News, a quarterly copy. You get discount on the merch that we're going to be putting out soon. free entry to the festival, and you get a chance also to vote in our patron polls. I think what we're doing for our stories now, we're going to put out a poll of four stories and you get to choose which one we cover. So with that, thanks very much for joining us today. As always, do send us in your thoughts and feedback on YouTube, on our Facebook page at InsmouthBookClub@outlook.com, and of course you can also send your questions to Father Dagon into DagonSack@outlook.com, which I think that will probably return next time, won't it, Tim?
Oh, it will indeed. It's grown bulbous again. Needs a good emptying.
On that rather dubious note, it's goodbye from me, Rob Poynton.
And it's goodbye from me, Tim Bendis.